This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
On today's edition of The Informer, we're breaking down the cost of youth homelessness for the Australian economy, and we'll also take a look at homelessness within the LGBTI community. Stephanie had a chance to catch up with Professor Adam Steen to talk about his research into the economic cost and possible solutions into the issue of youth homelessness. His research suggests that the current costs of youth homelessness to the country greatly surpass the amount of money that would be needed to provide earlier intervention practices in order to combat this issue. Here's what he had to say.
What instigated this research into youth homelessness and the costs of youth homelessness to Australia?
I've been working for a number of years with David McKenzie, who's associate professor at Swinburne, and David's done a lot of work in youth and disadvantage and homelessness over the years. We did a major report onto family homelessness back in 2007, and at the end of that, David said, we really don't have enough evidence, we really don't know how much youth homelessness is costing the community, so we really need to get together and do a big project on that. And that's where it all started, really, and we got funding from the Salvation Army, Mission Australia, Anglicare, and the Australian Research Council, and that's where it all started.
Okay, so how serious is the issue to the Australian economy?
Well, really serious. What we've done is we looked at, just in terms of health cost and justice cost, so basically, you know, the health services that young people use, you know, hospital, medical, dental, and then their interaction with police, justice system and courts. If you just look at those two costs of health and justice, young homeless people consume on average about $15,000 more than any other group in the community. So if we look at just members of the general population, we did a comparison as well with young unemployed people. And the young homeless people consume about $15,000 more resources than those other groups.
This was just in specialist homelessness services that go above and beyond the standard homelessness.
No. These are just kids who have just gone to a homeless service. Well, they were specialist homeless services that they reported to, but they were just kids looking for assistance. We surveyed them, over 300 of them, and we tracked them over 5 years and resurveyed them. And when you consider that 41,000 young people go to a specialist homeless service a year for assistance, multiply that by 15,000, it works out to be $626 million a year, just in those two costs alone.
Was there any indication in your research of how many of these young people get out of homelessness?
That's one of the things we're going to do now, is to really analyse the data over the whole 5 years. So what this final report shows is the cost. And that cost of $626 million excludes the cost of looking after young people or homeless people in general, which there's about $620 million in the specialist homeless service budget a year. And it doesn't even include the fact that most of the young people who go to homeless services drop out of school early, they don't complete school, so their lifetime earnings are affected, and in turn the economy loses tax revenue.
When we do talk about the additional specialist services above and beyond homeless refuges, the additional health and justice services, can you go into a bit more detail about what exactly these are and what they're being used for and why?
It's not sort of rocket science, this stuff. It basically, if you're a young homeless person or any homeless person, you're couch surfing, you're sleeping rough, you get sicker, you go to the general emergency wards more often. You know, you're exposed more to drugs, alcohol, those kind of issues. And in terms of the justice stuff, well, if you're on the street, you're more visible to police. And a lot of the time, these young people aren't committing crimes. They're actually victims of crime because they're out there and they can be hurt and so forth. So it's sort of understandable that they consume a lot more resources and a lot greater cost.
In the research here, I can see that it was found that more than a third of young people are leaving the family home due to family violence issues. What are the other two-thirds leaving home for?
Well, it could be a whole range of things. I mean, it might be their sexuality and that the parents are having issues with their parents. It could be drug and alcohol addiction issues. It could be things like even mental health. I mean, so many, a very high proportion of these young people have mental health issues. that could be either a cause or effect, and that's one of the things we've got to look at now and see, you know, what the relationship is. So there's a whole range of factors.
Yeah, I can see here that it was 53% of young people reported that they had been diagnosed with at least one mental health condition, which is pretty alarming. What are some of the early intervention recommendations that came through in this report?
There's some great examples of what should be done and what can be done. A couple of years ago, there was the Geelong project, which involved actually surveying all the kids in the Geelong region, looking at the issues and trying to identify which kids, which young people, you know, were at risk of either disengaging from school or leaving home. And about 500 young people were identified. 100 of those young people were put in under intensive case management, so there were, you know, resources, devoted counsellors and so forth, and assistance provided to their families and them to keep them in the family home. And that program was tremendously successful, and we know that the vast majority of the young people who received counselling and assistance stayed at the family home and stayed at school. So that's the kind of thing that can be done and that needs to be done. Not all young people can stay in the family home, of course, though, because of various issues. And what we're also advocating is that we have, as they have in the UK and France and elsewhere, youth foyer, where young people can go. If they can't stay in the family home, they can go to safe and secure accommodation. They can receive assistance to either maintain their schooling or go into employment or further training. And, you know, where they get supported accommodation, proper support, not just a place to live, but assistance to help them develop and become independent.
Yeah, and one of the other recommendations in the report was a long-term commitment to increasing the supply of youth-specific and youth-appropriate social housing. Research has shown that when talking about LGBTI youth in particular, LGBTI youth are at a higher risk of becoming homeless compared to other young people. What kind of youth-specific facilities are available to people, you know, individuals from the LGBTI community at the moment?
Well, I can't speak specifically for the community, but broadly I can say that there are an increasing number of these kind of foyer and foyer-like accommodation available. There are places like the Ladder Foyer in Collingwood, which has had tremendous success and results so far, supported by the AFL community. And there's places like that. There is a shortage, though. There is obviously a shortage, and we really need to have a good look at this, the whole early intervention thing. The Reconnect program's been tremendously successful in helping young people reconnect with their communities and school and families. But since Reconnect, which was developed over 20 years ago, there hasn't been a lot of movement. And we're hoping what we're saying will have resonance, particularly in an election year. And, you know, as you're saying, more specific accommodation and support is available at an early stage.
Yeah, obviously family plays a big part in this as well, because if you can keep kids at home in the first place, they're not going to need to go to a refuge. So what kind of work needs to be done there?
I think we need to look at the funding model. There are youth foyers that are being developed and are being developed, but they're critically short of money. There is money for people like building buildings, but there's not often a lot of thought put into the long-term resource requirements to staff and fund these and keep the support services going. We also need, as I said, a national strategy in terms of identifying young people at risk and really helping those young people at risk of leaving school and leaving home, you know, provide them with assistance to either stay at home or appropriate assistance, accommodation and support.
Yeah, and obviously all of these things, like you mentioned, cost money, but it's suggested in your research that the expenditure for these resources is going to cost potentially a lot less than it's what it's costing our society now. Do you know what the difference would be?
Yeah, look, there's an enormous difference, and this is the thing that we're saying to government. Early intervention saves money. If you think about it, what we're saying is there's this cost of health and justice services, $626 million a year. If we can intervene and get these young people to stay at home or put them into proper supported accommodation, then that cost is dramatically going to fall, because they're not going to go to be in the courts all the time, being picked up by the police. They're not going to be in the emergency, you know, wards of hospitals and so forth. If they can stay at school, they get a better education, they get a better job, and they can contribute back in their taxes. And also, if they're in proper supported accommodation, it reduces the cost long term of the homeless system itself, the supported homeless, the SHS, specialist homeless system. So there's massive savings, and the savings far, far outweigh the cost of the additional support and assistance at early intervention.
Well, Professor Adam Steen, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been great shedding light on this serious social and economic issue in Australia.
Oh, thank you very much for talking with me.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9. If you're just tuning in now, we've just heard from Adam Steen on his findings on the cost of homelessness for Australia's economy. Now we are joined live by Sherry Brunhout from Melbourne City Mission. Melbourne City Mission works with some of the most vulnerable people in the state, from children living with disability, young people experiencing homelessness, to people who need assistance in education and employment. MCM seeks to help these people escape and avoid disadvantage, economic exclusion and social isolation. Across the state, MCM is the biggest provider of homeless services for young people under 24. Sherry Brunhout is MCM's Director for Homelessness and Justice and works closely with LGBTI individuals who seek MCM services. Thanks for joining us, Sherry.
Pleasure to be here.
So of the 105,000 homeless people in Australia, well, that's actually a very large number, 105,000 homeless people in Australia, 42% are young people, which is even larger still in that age bracket. With 60% of homeless services being run by religious organisations, many LGBTA homeless youth avoid these services due to overwhelming feelings of alienation. But we want to know the message you wish to project to LGBT youth. Are they welcome?
Oh, they're absolutely welcome. I guess it's worth saying that there's two different types of services, I guess, that are available to people experiencing homelessness. There's funded services that are operated through the specialist homelessness system, which Adam was just talking about previously. Given that they're government-funded services, they might be delivered by religious organisations, but they certainly need to be compliant with all of the human rights acts that in terms of discrimination and other human rights that people are protected and covered by. So, accessing a homeless specialist homelessness service, I would expect that if people were feeling that they were being discriminated or that they're getting a less than fair service, that quite rightly that they would be taking that to a higher organisation to seek some justice. There are other types of homelessness services that have grown through religious organisations, if you like, and they're often street missionary type services that are sometimes about proselytising a faith, and run by volunteers. They're not funded services. They're not funded by the government to respond to homelessness in a systemic way. And sometimes when I hear stories from young people about where they have felt that they've received a less than ideal service, sometimes they are receiving that through religious organisations that are working through volunteer base. But it's very rare that you would hear that for people that are coming to a specialist homelessness service. It's their right to be accessing our services, and we absolutely, you know, would move mountains to protect people's rights to get what they're entitled to as a citizen in a very fair and equitable way.
Yeah, well, absolutely, because homelessness as an issue is something that doesn't discriminate, so it's only right that the services provided don't discriminate either.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, you said quite rightly, there's over 100,000 people in Australia who are homeless, and to put that in perspective, we are Melbourne City Mission, and if you think about the MCG, that's filling the MCG, and with a line of people coming out the door going for a good couple of blocks. So when you think about homelessness to that magnitude, it's shocking, and we should be shocked by that. We should be absolutely appalled. And when you think of that MCG, and almost a half of that MCG is full of people under 25 years, I mean, that should be the time where you're having the best time of your life, apparently. They're the best years of your life. They're the times where you should be laying down your future. But not having stable housing can really put a dent in those plans. So I've been a youth worker for 20 years, and I've met thousands of homeless young people from all walks of life. I've never met anyone who said that they wanted to be homeless or they wanted to keep being homeless. You talk to young people about where do you want to be in 5 years' time. They want to have a great house. They want to have a great job. They want to have a gorgeous partner. They want all the things that we all want. And the fact that they're struggling with homelessness at such an early age, when really they should be putting down the pathways to that great job and to those great relationships, and you know, it really makes it hard for them right from the get-go.
Well, absolutely. Well, for young people, what are the common circumstances around their homelessness? Like, what is bringing them to you for help?
So for most young people, up to about the age of 20, homelessness is often a response to family breakdown. And there's heaps of reasons why families break down. More than 70% of young people experience family breakdown that is accompanied by violence. So I think there's sometimes an idea that people might be homeless because they've run away from home because mum won't let them stay out late at night, or and there's some sort of choice in it. When you start looking at those sort of stats that say 70% have been, you know, have been involved in violence in the home, it gives you a pretty good idea of what it is they're coming from and the trauma that they've experienced. For young people sort of over 20, some of the main contributors are just sort of systemic poverty in some ways. So when you think about it, young people, if you haven't been able to lay down those pathways into career, or you're still in the process of laying that down, you know, youth allowance, if you're relying on youth allowance of, you know, a couple of $100 a week, there is actually no rental properties that fit the definition of affordable housing for young people on youth allowance. So I'm not sure what we think is going to happen to young people, but they actually can't afford to go into private rental. And if you can't live at home and you can't afford private rental, kind of there's not many other options for young people. And so we're not surprised then that they drop out of secure housing and end up requiring homelessness services.
Well, yeah, absolutely. We're kind of like shutting off any possible pathways and then asking them why they're homeless.
Absolutely. And for young people, GLBTI young people, we find that family breakdown is a major contributor to the reasons why they become homeless. And we do find that they are overrepresented in the lower age bracket than what they should be. And often that's about a family breakdown and having a culture clash or a lack of understanding coming from families. So those young people really do find it very hard. They can often then find it also hard to access services because sometimes they might have experienced some sort of disadvantage, which then puts them off trying to come to services because they're not quite sure what the outcome's going to be.
For this reason, then, do you think that there is a need and a demand to have systems and services that are tailored specifically to the needs of LGBTI youth?
Yeah, it's a real Pandora box. So at Melbourne City Mission, we talk to young people about what our services should be like, and we talk to young people quite often about what we're running, how we're going, what can you help us to make it better? And we've had an ongoing debate and discussion about whether or not GLBTI young people would like... the first sort of ongoing debate that we've been having is whether or not we even ask young people...
to identify themselves.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's two very strong camps of young people advising us who are saying... it's not an issue. Don't ask us. If it's an issue that you need to know about, we will tell you and we'll ask you. If we want you to do something to help us with that, we'll let you know. Otherwise, mind your business. It's not, you know, it's not relevant to my housing. And then another group of young people who are quite clearly saying it's always relevant. It's who I am and it's how I identify. So absolutely engage me in that conversation. So it's a really interesting debate that we're having about when we first meet young people and we get their demographic information, we're not even clear about whether or not young people want to identify at that point in time.
That idea of, oh, I shouldn't have to tell you, that could also be preventing people from getting specific services that they need. And that could also come from, you know, this feeling of, I can't tell people about who I am because they might just be coming from a house that's recently broken down due to their sexuality. And we should be able to say, hey, you can comfortably tell us who you are from the moment you step into our doors. And specifically for trans youth, this is a massive issue because so many feel like they can't stay safely in a refuge for homeless people due to their gender identity.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of young people, trans young people, because of their experiences, have good reasons to be worried and good reasons to be cautious about their safety. At Melbourne City Mission, we absolutely ensure that young people will get a safe response. We are the refuge, and the nature of the word refuge is about providing a space for time out, for safety, for to be protected for a period of time. So our job is to earn the trust of these young people so that they can talk to us about what is going on in their lives, who are they, how do they identify themselves, what is important to them, and how do we tailor what we're doing to make that the best possible service to get those young people back on their feet, out of homelessness, and getting on with their lives, getting on to that career, the house, the job, the beautiful partner that we all want, and getting Melbourne City Mission kind of out of their lives. As much as we love them, we want to let them go, and we want to help them to be able to let us go at the end too.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for the work that you're doing for all the LGBTI youth and youth in general in homelessness. If you need support and are unaware of who to contact, you can call Melbourne City Mission on 9611 2411. If you need urgent assistance, please call Lifeline on 131114. Sherry, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolute pleasure.
Just tuning in now, that was Sherry Brunhout from Melbourne City Mission. They're doing great work for homelessness across Melbourne, and you should definitely check out their website, even if it's not an issue that affects you, just to read up on it, because at the end of the day, this is kind of something that can affect anybody out of nowhere, and as well as it's something that we should be more educated about. A full rundown of today's story will be on the Joy website shortly. You're listening to The Informer, Joy's current affair program for issues that we think need more exposure. A massive thank you again to our guests today, Professor Adam Steen and Sherry Brunhout from Melbourne City Mission. Today's show was produced by Stephanie McLean and myself. I'm Emma Arnold, by the way, if anybody wants to know who is, you know, talking into your ears the past half hour about youth homelessness. For a podcast of today's program and our other stories, please visit joy.org.au/The Informer. The Informer will be back tomorrow at 6:30, and up next is Outtakes with Daniel. Once again, I'm Emma Arnold. Thanks for joining us on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.